ICEA Gear has outfitted over 10,000 bow hunters across the country, and we're continuing to raise the bar when it comes to bow hunting camo. New for the 23 season, we introduce our never-before-seen panel fabric system designed to be dead quiet, along with our patent-pending bow hunting collar. ICEA Gear. Features and function built for bow hunters by bow hunters. Learn more at asiogear.com.
In wild country, the challenge of what's outside brings you closer to what's inside. Don't miss Wild Country, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, presented by Expedition Enterprises. Waypoint TV.
Welcome to Bear Bow Hunter Podcast with your host, Nate Bailey, where we look to the ancient paths of our hunting ancestors to guide our future, where woodsmanship and hard work outweigh advanced shooting devices, where we value those who have gone before us and welcome those who are yet to come. Join us as we exchange valuable insight about the bear bow hunter's lifestyle. Hey guys, before we jump into this podcast, I'd just like to remind you, if you're getting anything from the podcast that we're bringing to you, we finance these things by trying to sell quality t-shirts and quality hats, and they're all our own designs, something that we're trying to do just to take care of all the, you know, the money behind the scenes. If you could just go over there and check it out, maybe just browse through it. If you can't buy anything, just browse through it. That helps our standing also on Google. So that's a couple things that you could do to help us keep bringing this to you. Now let's get on with the show. Welcome to another edition of Bear Bow Hunters, and today we have with us Aaron Snyder again. How you doing, Aaron?
Good, man. It's been a while.
It's been too long. Too long. I've been kind of following what you've been busy this last year.
Yeah, I have. You know, COVID kind of screwed up my my primary plans for the season. But my my buddy Scotty, he's the one I guide for down in Texas for Owdad in the Davis Mountains and up north in the Panhandle, and mule deer as well. So that kind of worked out good. I was able to hunt Oklahoma and Texas quite a bit in the months I'm usually, you know, in generally anyway, in Alberta hunting mule deer or moose or something. So I just guided for him for 3 months straight, 4 months almost. So it worked out good, just coming back and forth working and then helping him out.
Right, right. And do you do show stuff with Kafaru normally?
I'm a bit introverted, so I don't go to a lot of that. I have a marketing lady that she goes and has a crew, but I do seminars, so I've done a few of those in the last month, and I've got a couple more coming up. So
gotcha. Yeah, I was just wondering if COVID kind of messed that up and made more hunting time for you.
Yeah, well, I just don't go. Usually I have my crew go and then I go do whatever. So I mean, you know, people definitely, I get it. Some they made a cardboard cutout of me actually to be a hard ass. So, but yeah, it worked out okay, you know, considering, you know, everything going on.
Right, right. Yeah, it's been a tough year. You know, it did create a lot of time for us to go hunting this year, which was kind of nice, but all the other stuff, yeah. Yeah. Anyhow, I was going to get you on here. There's something that I haven't done, and I got to do before I get too much older, and that's some high country mule deer stuff. And so between you and South, I think, are the guys in the traditional bow hunting world that you could really talk to about this and get, you know, an honest scoop. And I listened to a podcast that you did with one of the guys you met up in the high country. And and I'm kind of in that same boat. So I was just going to kind of pick your brain and see what kind of things a guy should start doing now. And it'll be next year. I can't hunt this year. The Air Guard decided they're going to send me down to Missouri. So
where are you going down there?
Oh, I have to go to a school. So I switched jobs. I'm in the Air Guard, and I'm going to finish out my time. I was in the Coast Guard before, and now I'm going to finish out my military time and, you know, kind of draw a little bit of a check there, and mainly for health insurance. But I'm in what they call command post, so I have to reclass.
Gotcha. You're not going to Leonard Wood, are you?
No, no. My son went through Leonard Wood.
Is he called Bravo?
No, he's a let me see, what was he? He was a military police. What is that? 11? No, that's not 11. I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't 12 Bravo. That's what I did. Was a combat engineer, like explosives and shit. So.
Oh yeah, yeah, that would be fun. That sounds a whole lot more fun to go to that school than what I'm going to. Basically, I'm going to learn how to be Radar O'Reilly.
gotcha. Well, good luck with that.
So, anyhow, I was just thought I'd get you on here and kind of pick your brain. A guy new to this, and especially, you know, you've lived in Oregon, you grew up in Oregon, so you know, my biggest fear is like the high altitude. How do you prepare yourself for the altitude?
Man, I don't. I live at 10,000 feet. I've been at high altitude the majority of my, even when I lived in Detroit, you know, we were at Three Finger Jack, Mount Jefferson, up a little bit higher, but
right.
Anybody can get altitude sickness. You know, that's the biggest concern. Just getting your butt kicked is one thing, and, you know, you can recover from that, but altitude sickness, you got to drop altitude and obviously, by default, drop out of the deer. So, I mean, a few things, and I'm not an expert on hypoxia or you know, pulmonary edema or anything like that, but Frank did get it a couple times, you know, my partner,
yeah.
Faru. The big thing is, well, there's a few things. One, acclimate. So if you get there like at noon on, you know, Friday, stay the night at the trailhead, get used to that altitude, go relatively slow going in. That's the problem with Frank is he's so tough mentally. He'll push it so hard at a level that I don't think a lot of people probably realize, where he, from those lungs, you know, compressing, you know, that your lungs are basically expanding and contracting.
Right.
And he's pushing through that, which makes it even worse. And again, I'm not an expert on that, but staying hydrated, you know, electrolyte mix is important. Acclimate and, you know, take your time. And the thing is, coming from, you know, a decent idea of your background, because I'm from Oregon, you're not glassing a lot.
Right.
And so, you know, you're going to have to find the, you know, minus the Mortal Kombat of, you know, hunting public land, there's not as many mule deer hunters. So a lot of times you get to an area that you're alone or whatever, spending that first day behind glass, really picking apart the terrain and letting your body acclimate, it isn't a horrible idea. So it's different for me because I just don't suffer from altitude. I do very well at it, but that's not to say I don't get my butt kicked, right? So a lot of times when we hike in, you know, it's anywhere from probably the closest is 5 miles, probably the farthest is maybe 11 or 12. And wherever we go to, we set up camp, we make sure we're eating, you know, we do, we pack about 3,500 calories a day. We make sure and eat the best we can, all of our food, you know. Now I'll go into food later, but days that are easier and we're not going into caloric deficit, we may save food from that day in case we have to extend the hunt. But the moral of the story is nutrition. Get food in your body. Your body needs food. Electrolytes. Make sure and bring an electrolyte mix. Do not bring anything like creatine that dehydrates you. Any right. diuretic, you got to be careful with. Not saying don't drink coffee. I can't imagine very many people on the planet don't drink something in the morning to wake up. But make sure to pound water after that just to stay hydrated. You know, if you do that and you still get altitude sickness, you're prone to it. And then, you know, you may want to get some prescriptions. You know, you may want to take something for it.
Gotcha. Yeah, so that was one of my big concerns was the altitude, and if there was something that a person could do to kind of get themselves used to it before they get there, you know. I think the highest we hunt an area here that's about 7,000 feet, and you could feel it, but you're not going to get altitude sickness or anything. You could just feel, you know, the difference in the air pressure up there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I get it. I mean, obviously, it's different. We're here at 13,000 feet is probably where I really start to, you know, feel it, where I can see a difference. But I'm lucky. Like I said, I live at 10 to 12 doesn't really affect me. I mean, it affects me some, but it's not like, you know, everywhere you hunt has a different issue. Oregon would be rain, right? Underbrush, deadfall.
Yeah.
There is none of that here, right? Here is altitude and, you know, climbing, right? It's just super aggressive terrain. And you can't fight your way through, you know, and there's no oxygen. There's just no oxygen. You got to take your time. The other thing is packing, you know. Overpacking is a big one. If you listen to that podcast, that big bastard packed in, I think, 78 pounds. you know, and you do what you got to do, right? If you need that much gear, you need that much. But, I mean, you want to go as Spartan as possible without potentially, you know, coming out early because of something going wrong. But, you know, field craft and, you know, just having a grasp of what you're doing back there, you know, the better your field craft is, the less gear you generally need to take.
Right.
You know, so if you can keep your pack really low without hitting like a danger zone, that's another good thing. 'Cause then you're not smoking yourself as bad coming in.
Right. Right. Yeah. I have my pack down quite a ways. The only difference would be food for that length of time. You know, I have a good down sleeping bag and things like that, and then you don't need much to sleep on. I don't know, what do you carry a tarp up there? Do you carry a full, you know, a full teepee, or what do you carry?
So it really depends. Like, I'm not, you know, obviously I own Kefaru, but I'm not married to just using our shelters. If it's applicable to use something else, I certainly will. So if the weather, you know, I do these seminars and I break it down the same way. It has to do with the time I'll be in there.
Right.
The heading in, you know, the terrain heading in, the potential weather, you know, are the big ones. So if I'm heading in for a very long, long distance for a short period of time, I'm bringing a tarp because I can make it through anything for 3 to 5 days.
Yeah.
If I'm going a long, long ways in, and I'm staying for a long period of time, I'm probably going to bring a Hillebert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm going a short ways in, I'll probably pack whatever I want because I don't care because it's not very far, right? So
right.
That way, I don't ever bring a stove for these high country archery hunts. It's just, we're not going to burn wood, right? The weather's nice enough.
Mm-hmm.
So really, like, if I had to choose one shelter right now or one system, you know, right now for best all around, for high country, it would probably be a tarp and a bivy. And when I say that, meaning a good bivy, not like a Gore-Tex coffin that you got to climb in, you know, one with a decent link zipper.
Gotcha.
Because if I got to sleep in a deer bed, which is very possible, it doesn't take up a ton of room.
Mm-hmm.
The tarp allows me, you know, that gives me plenty of cover. But what also gives me when it's hot is I'm out of the sun and wind's blowing through, depending upon how I pitch it. And then the next would be, you know, a Hillebert. That's also a great option. You don't have to worry about bugs up high. So the whole mosquito thing is kind of, you know, 12,000 feet, there's no mosquitoes. So.
Gotcha. Yeah, I didn't even take that into account. It looks like there would be on some of those seeps and stuff that I've seen you, you know, with your pictures on. You'd think there would be up there.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. But, you know, in the wind, obviously that helps with bugs and everything. But, you know, when I say most well-rounded people listen to this, meaning if you're going in and let's say, you know, with mule deer, right, there's, you know, there's a lot of basins, right? There's a lot of potential movement. You know, you're not – where when you're in timber, right, especially in Oregon, Roosevelts don't blow out very far. They stop in the timber. You know, and when you're talking about elk, you know, they're in the timber normally. Where with mule deer, you know, they'll travel a couple basins away.
Hmm.
Sometimes it's good to leave the tarp and roll out light for a couple days, grab your bivy, leave the tarp there. One, it's a decoy, so people think you're still there and may not come in and hunt that basin. And then two, you can cover up whatever you need to leave. I'll usually leave it in a dry sack, anything important. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't want anything stolen or eaten.
Right.
And then take that bivy and roll out. I'm going super lightweight, 2 pound shelter or less. And, you know, I got enough cover, right? I got a rain fly. If I have to set my pack outside, you know, so different options, right? Where we've got the tent, nothing wrong with a tent. You're carrying a little bit more weight, a little bit bigger footprint. And sometimes it's just where we camp it just sucks. We're literally in a cliff edge, sit laying in a deer bed in a rock field. Yeah. You have to do that? No, but if it gets me closer to killing something, I certainly would.
Yeah, it looks pretty badass. You can tell from the day that you walk in, you know, in your pictures, and then the day you walk out, you can tell that it's hard on you.
Yeah, you know, we talked about, I carry an ice axe walking stick a lot, and, you know, I've gotten crap for that. Like, what do you think? You're an ice climber. I'm not using it to climb anything. I'm digging. So there's three primary things. Well, four. One, it's a walking stick.
Sure.
And two, I can dig out seats, and water is a high commodity up high. Mm. So I'll dig out seeps, drainages, ways to get water. You know, and people, like, you could see lights popping on in people's heads. I will take my dry sack and I will manufacture a drip down to that dry sack, and I'll leave that all day. Hmm. And so my dry sack's filling up with water.
Yeah.
All along. I carry either a half gallon or full gallon Ziploc bag in my bino harness. And that way, when I'm going on a stalk, if I get jammed up, I just take out a Ziploc bag, fill it with water, drop MSR Aqua Tabs in it, drink it right out of the Ziploc bag, dry it out, put it back in my chest rig. It's a container to hold water.
That's pretty badass. It really is when you're thinking on those terms.
Man, I tell you, and South's a badass too, right? South, yeah. South knows, right? He'd be telling you the same things I do. Like, we've taken our maps, used those for irrigation ditches, basically to fund water. That ice axe, I dig my deer bed out to a human bed, or whatever I have to do to, make a flatter, more comfortable surface where I'm sleeping. So, you know, I mean, you do what you got to do, right? And sometimes you got to do some shit you never would have thought about.
Right, right. And,
you know, when you're pissing blood because you're dehydrated and you're, you know, got, you know, your kidneys are killing you and your back hurts and everything, yeah, you're going to find a way, right? You're going to find somehow to become more comfortable.
Right, right. Well, and see, the cool thing about something like me being able to ask you this is you learned all that the hard way. And not that I'll be able to know things by going up there just by, you know, asking questions, but things will pop in my head like, oh, yeah, well, he did this. Now maybe I could think my way through this, you know?
Well, I'll give you an idea, like, and you know the history of me with a stick, right? I started in 16, went to a compound in 17, came back to a stick bow. So we did a 15-day backpack hunt. Frank and I were separated. Most of it, you know, he was in a different area. I think he killed his on day 11. I did not kill one. We had to come out, literally stayed home a day and came back in. Well, you know, during that time, I don't think that people realize food deprivation, sleep deprivation. I mean, I look like, avocado on a toothpick, right? A caloric deficit every day. And you're just, you got to find a way. And I'm not trying to glorify it or like gritty the hell out of it, right? But I mean, you do run into problems. You got to find solutions for
right.
them. So, you know, there are times when you're back there that, you know, you might talk yourself off the mountain because you have to drop 1,000 feet to get water and you just don't have it in you. And so for me, like when I first took up on some of these stocks, I started with my big pack and I'm like, yeah, that ain't happening. I'll just have to carry the basic essentials. Well, then water was a problem. So I just started putting a life straw in my cargo pocket and I would suck water out of creeks on the way back. Back to my, you know, after the stock back, cause you know, it's 1.5 to 3 miles per stock, depending upon where we're at. And so then I'm like, you know, even this life straw is stupid. Cause I'm sucking my cooter vein out of my head trying to get water. You know? So then I'm like, I'll just take a Ziploc. And what I would do is I'd go to the first creek, fill it up, lay there, clean myself off, you know. I'd even strip down to my, you know, my undies, right, and take a bath, basically.
Right.
Let the 20 to 30 minutes for those tabs to kick in. Down some water, just carry the bag in my hand, bow in the other one, stop every now and then, rehydrate, hit the next water source, fill that thing up again. Then I would just pack it back to camp, drop that in my Nalgene, and then I've got some extra water that I didn't have before I left. So it's just being resourceful, basically.
Right, right. Yeah, no, that's really cool. That's good stuff. as far as food, what do you do for food?
So there's a few different things. The first thing, 100 calories per ounce. You know, with today's technology and food, which there is technology in that, you can get about 120 calories per ounce, especially if you're at a high fat content. So we do a little bit of everything as far as dinners go. We try to make our own. If we don't make our own, we'll use brown light rice top ramen, basically. It's like the poor man's mountain house. It's super cheap, very good for you. We make our own seasoning for that. So imagine just cooking on the – so if you look at the glycogen index, there's fast-burning and slow-burning carbs. Yeah. Brown rice is a slower-burning carb.
Right.
Brown rice, top ramen, basically. We make our own seasoning so it doesn't have way too much sodium but enough. And then we take olive oil tuna packets. That olive oil obviously helps your regularity as far as pooing, which does become a problem up there.
Yeah.
Tuna protein. You know, I'm getting – where I'm losing my 100 calories per ounce in the tuna, I do get that with the olive oil, but I'm gaining it with the carbs and the you know, and my seasoning. Anyway, that's one way to do it. The also is just dehydrate your own food. Put a lot of virgin olive oil or avocado oil in it. You know, when you make a roast with veggies in it, just dehydrate that. That's your dinner. Just rehydrate it when you're back there. I do a lot of anything with peanut butter, anything with high fat. You know, there's different bars we take. Metrex Big 100 chocolate chip cookie dough bars, not the healthiest thing for you. They're 410 calories each at 3.75 ounces. So I'm hitting that 100 calorie per ounce limit. And you got to just figure, you're a big dude. I mean, you're about my size. What are you, 210, 215?
Yeah, I probably should be around 190, though.
I probably should be too, and you probably will be after the mule deer.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I'm sitting at probably 215 right now, and I've put on a little bit of muscle that I'll lose over scouting season. Right. So I try to pack in 2 pounds of food at a minimum. So 16 ounces, right, times two, 32 ounces, yeah. You know, 2 pounds, 16 ounces in a pound. So 14 days, that's 28 pounds of food.
Yep. Yeah, that's and a lot.
Yeah, I like to eat. So, you know, just certain things to think about. If you don't have a fast-burning metabolism, you're in a little bit easier area where your caloric burn isn't as high. Right. You can get away with less, but you don't want to go on a 10-day hunt starving yourself, because about day five, you're going to start to bonk and crap out.
Yeah.
So I've obviously done it enough to where I know exactly what I need, within reason anyway. So I would say err on the side of caution. If you track your food for a month, you know how people will do the – why don't I have any money? And then they track their, you know, what they're buying. And then you're like, Jesus, I'm pissing away money at the gas station every day. Same principle, yeah. Tracking your food. If your caloric intake at home is 4,000 calories a day, you're going to need to pack a lot of food.
Right, right. Or start working on it now, you know, and yeah. Getting yourself used to things.
Yeah, or probably, honestly, change your diet, because most people's diet sucks. So, you know, changing your diet helps too.
Yeah, mine's pretty good when I pay attention to it, but until you hit the weekend, and then it sucks.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, when people know that, or you know what I mean, when you have a right. Fairly good what you're taking, that's half the battle right there, because then you're like, you know, I'm eating about 30,000 a day on bad days. I'm eating 2,400 on good days. Yeah, I can probably get around with 2,800 to 3,200. And at least then you know you're not going to bonk when you're back there. You may right. Not be in great shape, but you're in good shape. And the human body can go 2 weeks without food. So, you know, you don't want to starve yourself, but, you know, you don't want to be a weenie either and pack out early. Oh, this food's just not getting in and I'm tired. I'm going home. That's kind of a cop-out. A lot of people do that. You can mentally make it through about anything. You just want to set yourself up for success and not failure.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, this year elk season, we got into elk early, and then my kid was like, hey, we need to go down into this basin. And we've been in there several times, and it's just, it sucks to get back out of there. And then you kill something down there, and it really sucks to get it out. But, and he's like, that's where they are. We got to go down in there. And, you know, I'd put on extra weight and really not worked out like I was normally doing. And yeah, so I understand that mental game is the biggest thing. We ended up going down there and shooting two bulls, which was a good deal. But
that'll make.
We should have ate them down there, but
That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it was Eastern Oregon, so it was easier to pack out, but it's steeper than crap in there for about 4 miles. So yeah, it's a tough little pack out, but at the same time, you know, those little mind games that we were sitting there talking, I was talking in my head going, I don't want to go down in there, but if I didn't, we would have probably not even got into bulls, you know, that week.
Yeah. I mean, and there's something to be said about that. Mule deer the same way. Like, you know, Bart Lancaster, he's a buddy of mine in BC. He always, you know, hunt the unbothered, you know, hunt the unpressured.
Yeah.
That's hard to do anymore unless you put yourself through some physical abuse or you have an unlimited budget, which we don't. So, right. You know, and I mean, as I say that, like, I can't afford to go on the Hill Ranch or some of these, you know, hunts that people get to go on. More power to them and nothing against them, right? I don't have that cash. And I have, you know, I'm getting to hunt more and more stuff than I normally couldn't, but I still am doing a lot of public land, you know, hunts. Just got to work harder. There's just no way around it.
Right, right. And, you know, that same unit we hunt is just so full of roads that, I mean, we called in like 3 pickups. Not people on their feet, but 3 pickups over there. Lord. Yeah.
I think I know that, actually, now that you're saying that. I used to live in Redmond, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, you know exactly where I was then. Yeah. We hunt.
Happened back in 2005 to me, so not much has changed, I guess. A lot of dirt bikes, actually.
Yeah, quads and dirt bikes. And you know, the good thing is most of the time, though, those guys are back into camp by 11. So, you know, really when you're shooting a bull, it's you know, from that time to 4 when they come back out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep.
But every time you're calling on a bull, you're just like, oh, I hope somebody doesn't show up here. We've actually shut up and hoped the bull would shut up and let people pass and then keep going after the pickup passes.
Yeah, it's crazy. I make, you know, jokes about Mortal Kombat hunting. But, you know, I mean, it is what it is. You find a way. Same principle. I mean, if you want to kill something bad enough, you'll figure it out.
Yeah, I have a buddy, Travis Yawn, and he hunts. He just started hunting high country mule deer in Nevada. And he's the one, you know, has kind of been pushing me and saying, hey, man, you need to get out and do this. This is a ball. He says it's not easy at all, but it's a ball. So that's one of the big things that, you know, I've been looking at down the road is, shoot, I'm 50 now, so it's going to be – I still got a few years, but I want to start.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you know, the thing I'm looking at, I'm 44. By the time I'm, you know, hitting that 50-plus range – I'll probably get some pack goats or a llama or something. The thing is that does cut out some of the battle, or if you get dropped off, it still sucks. I mean, you still got to hike to the deer and pack. You know what I mean? There's still a lot to it. So
right.
There's no easy day back there in rough country for mule deer.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, a lot of that hunting, it's kind of like the poor man's, you know, sheep hunt, isn't it?
100%. I mean, yeah, you know, as you know, I've helped a lot of sheep hunters.
Right.
You know, I didn't, but I can't afford $30,000 or 16 or 24 for a sheep tag. So the Owdad is kind of, it's technically actually, I think a mountain or some type of goat, but mm-hmm. It's a poor man's hunt. Mule deer, poor man's, you know, sheep, and nothing wrong with people that can afford that. But when you can't, you still get the same, you know, I say feel, but I mean, you're still doing the same type of, you know, backpack hunting and stalking and glassing. It's, you know, and honestly, if I had to pick, I'd hunt, you know, mule deer. I like mountain goat hunting too, but mule deer over sheep. I like hunting sheep. It's just not the same for me as a mule deer. Something about a mule deer in its bed just trips your trigger.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you've shot some really close.
Couple. Yeah. I shot one at 4 feet, better. My broadhead was between its horns when I drew back. Talk about a pucker factor moment, because you know, I had hit an elk 2 days earlier in the leg. This was my first year, you know, hunting with a stick bow.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, it was one of those deals where if I would have hit the elk in the guts, I probably wouldn't have kept elk hunting in the leg. I really didn't, you know, whatever, it's fine. I ain't shit. I'm not going to tag over that. But so we took a couple days off of mule deer hunting, and Frank and I went in. And it did not help my mental game for accuracy because it was only at 4 feet, right? It made me feel good that I got the deer, but right. It's not like it's like, oh, I got my crap together. I made a good shot. I mean, it wasn't very hard to hit it at 4 feet, right? But the stock, it was the most adrenaline-filled stock you could ask for. I mean, just unbelievable. And then, like I said, when I had to hold my bow arm up higher into my chest to get the bow drawn, so I almost had to pull my bow arm back and then push my bow forward to get it to, because I was so close to that deer.
Yeah, and then your processor, did you get to your clicker when you shot him?
You know, I wasn't on a clicker. You know, I make jokes, I don't really use the clicker when I hunt.
Right.
The bottom line, I use that clicker for training, and I either pull it long or anymore just cut it off when I'm hunting, because, you know, I practice enough.
Yeah.
But like with that, I don't know what happened. I mean, honestly, I was crapping my pants so bad. And, you know, I was at 12 yards. Frank's got these photos of this. I'm throwing rocks. And you know, when you stalk on these deer, the top 4 inches of the tines tell you everything you need to know. That's all you want to watch. Figure out which way the main beam's facing so you know they're away or looking at you. When right. I say looking at you, I'm in bed. And then when they start to twitch, you know, if they're going to get up or whatever. So, yeah, I'm throwing rocks. Like the last rock I threw was the size of a softball. And it he didn't move. You know, he planted for that, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 hours or whatever to get fed again. And I had about a 30-mile-an-hour cross gust. So I'm like, hell, I'll just get right up on it. So every 30-mile-an-hour gust, I would take a step. I'd wait 30 seconds, 45, a minute. Whoosh. I take another step. Well, 12 yard, you know, it took 5 minutes. I got to literally, 5 feet from it, you know, in length. And then I went to step up on that rock during the gust, and it blew me back off. And I was like, oh, and he did not hear. And I'm talking like, a body length away. And I got above it, and I was like, I could see my shadow just in its ears. And I'm like, oh, I can't go any. I think it was a mountain lion, right, when that shadow comes over.
Right.
So I was all kinds of contorted and drew back and straight down and shot it. It was a pretty cool experience. Never would have happened with a compound in my hand, I can tell you that. So that was one of those eye openers where the stick bow, you know, it's not to, you know, kumbaya, but it's like, okay, this is the way to do it. Like, this is awesome. I would have never done that with a compound, you know, and to get that close, you've definitely done your job. You know what I mean?
Right. You're more on the line of like a cougar than something far out there, you know, you right at that where you could smell them.
Yeah. You know, it's just a matter of, I wasn't using technology to, nothing against compound guys, you know, right. But for me, showing that, you know, yep, it wasn't technology that puts this thing on the ground. It was, you know, obviously me and Frank's field experience, animal behavior and stalking skills. Sure. So it was a good pick me up for me because it was a rough road to hoe that first year.
Yeah. You did well. You did really well. A lot better than most guys do. So,
it was a cool year, good learning experience. And, yeah, I ended up, I don't know how many animals I ended up shooting, 9 or 10 maybe. And
yeah.
I learned so much with each animal. Right.
Right.
Every one of those where I walked away with not one or two or three, like I could have wrote a giant notebook of what I learned on each hunt. Cause I was learning more and more how to hunt and not more and more on technology, and which is cool. I mean, and mule deer, when you go, believe me, you will be like, you know, there will be a list a mile long of what you learned or did wrong.
Right.
And it's not that you don't know what you're doing. You just never hunted a high country mule deer, you know? So yep. You'll learn a lot while you're doing it, especially reading animals in their bed.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the whole lure to it, you know, because I'm so keyed into elk, and elk, you treat them like you just keep the wind with you and then piss them off. And you know, they come to you, stalking something, I think, you know, and I get my butt kicked by these blacktails. I don't know. I saw probably 15 good, big, mature blacktails. And I could get within 50 easy, but I could not get within 25, 30 to save my life. And
black duck.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. But they're cool. I mean, and my brother-in-law, he was right up next to me. He drove right past my Suzuki that day and went down there and shot just a toad.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I've shot a few blacktail, but I definitely probably be tree stand hunting them.
I'm hitting them in out of a tree stand is the only way.
Definitely.
But that's hard on me. It'd be one thing. I could probably put a stock on a mule deer that's sitting down there because I know it's there. My problem with sitting in a tree stand is I'm second guessing myself the whole time. And you probably wouldn't because you've hunted quite a bit of whitetails and stuff out of tree stands. But I get to where I'm like, well, you know, I thought this funnel was good, but I see a deer over there using that, so I should move over there. But you can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's anytime, whether it's blacktails or, whitetail or whatever, the grass is greener than syndrome is very, very, very difficult to turn your head on, you know, like, you know, in the moment you move your tree stand, then he's over where you were and you're kicking yourself in the butt. So
right.
It is what it is. But, and you know, high country mule deer is not too much different. We talked about this a lot in the last seminar as far as glassing. We glass for 4, 6, 8 hours straight. And when you know there's animals in the basin you're at and you're not finding them, it's hard not to pick up and move to a different basin. Sometimes it's the right call. But sometimes, you know, you just need to really, really wait it out in patience and just glass. I mean, there's times we've glassed basins for 6 hours, sun shifted, and where we've been glassing for 6 hours, there's 14 mule deer that just popped out. And so we, you know, we literally have our optics, you know, binos or a spotter on a tripod at a minimum for 6 hours a day. And that's a minimum. If you're flagging a guy in, you're on that thing literally 10 hours, sun up till sundown, maybe more. A lot of people aren't used to that, and it's hard to sit there that long.
Right, right. That, you know, that kind of does bring us back to gear, too. As far as binoculars or spotting scopes, what do you usually take? Do you take both?
Yeah, without a doubt. I take 10s and generally an 85 or a 95 spotter, generally a 95. So 85 is fine. A 65 is fine, but you want a higher end one or the highest end you can afford. What happens is, you know, the human eye, how you get headaches is when you have chromatic aberration or edge to edge clarity issues.
Mm-hmm.
The human is looking for perfection. So as you shift your eye into that objective and it starts to hit, you know, unclear or not perfectly clear glass, it shoots back to the center. And so you'll drift, shoots back, and you do that for 4 to 6 hours.
Mm.
It's going that sweet spot in the center, you're going to get migraines. You're going to get horrible headaches. And so I always try to, you know, and I know not everybody can afford them, buy the highest end glass you can. And if you can't afford a high end spotter and binos, don't buy medium range of both. Buy high end binoculars.
Gotcha.
Don't buy the mid range of each. Just buy high end binos and put them on a tripod. That'll be enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a set of razors, I think, would probably be what I would start with and then go from there. But
gotcha.
Yeah. So that was another. So I'm just trying to picture your pack here. And of course, you're probably not taking in any extra set of clothes. It's what you got on.
So I take one extra set of socks, maybe an extra set of underwear.
Yeah.
Pants I have on. I have the shirt I have on. A fleece, like a grid fleece top, a puffy jacket, and rain gear. And that's all we bring.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about rain gear, if you took rain gear with you.
You know, in Nevada, you can hit torrential downpours. I'm not an expert on Nevada, but I would say, you know, a good, you don't have to worry about underbrush or hunting, you know, the west coast of, you know, Oregon or,
right,
or BC, Idaho. Just get a good set of lightweight rain gear. You don't need to reinvent the wheel on it. Just, you know, you may be going through some squalls or early snowstorms, so you don't have to have crazy durable rain gear, but you do want rain gear.
Yeah. Yeah. Just something to keep you alive if you had to sit through a storm.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, in some of those storms, they may be rolling in on a stock. And so I try to carry like a final approach or an assault pack. So in the case of what we South and I designed a lid called a Bane pack, and it'll hold your footwear in it on the stock. So if you're in your socks, having that, they throw rain gear in there if a storm's blowing in on the stock, because there's nothing worse than, you know, the mile and a half hike back getting drenched and nothing you can do about it, where, you know, a set of 2 pound rain gear is not going to kill you. You know, to have it with you for peace of mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a little, little fold up Cabela's. I don't remember what to call them, Instinct or whatever, but they're really, really small. I wouldn't want to, you know, hike forever in them, 'cause you'd sweat to death, but it works really good to keep yourself halfway dry, so you don't, you know, get in your sleeping bag completely sopping.
Yeah. Oh yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, when you, for, well, example, 2019, well, you know, Frank and I went in, and he killed his buck. He had to leave. I stayed in there. I ended up actually missing the buck you heard about on that podcast. Mm-hmm. When I came there, I ended up killing a buck. I had dropped my big pack on the other side of this mountain range, and it's hard to describe with words because it was horrible. But I had my Bane pack, and I'm like looking at this massive mountain I have to climb to get to my big pack. Yeah, that ain't happening. So I literally stuffed, I mean, that thing was blowing out at the zip. Like, I stuffed as much deer as I could in that mule deer. And then I strapped crap to it, and I carried a game bag in my left hand and my bow in my right, and climbed the 2 miles back to my pack. And then it started to snow. I messaged Frank. You know, what happened is I talked to my wife and Randy Cooling too long. I called my wife. She's a huge motivator for me, you know what I mean? Like, it's always hear her voice. Called Randy, told him what happened, and I'm like, dude, I got to go. I mean, literally, a snowstorm came in and just pissed snow. And so I'm running around trying to find wood I can burn bristle. And I cooked 2 top ramens and put 2 of the olive oil tuna packets, scarfed those down, hiding in my tent, freezing, shivering, tried to use my stove to warm it up. And I'm like, okay, I got my rain gear on, and I ran around like an idiot trying to warm my body and look for firewood, built a big fire, dried my crap out, got a hold of Frank on my inReach and said, hey, can you come in and help me pack all this out? And I said, I will be, you know, basically here. And, you know, if Frank's anything, he's dependable. Here comes Frank, 6:30 in the morning, sun hasn't come up, coming down this god-awful ski slope we have to hike. It's just zigzags the whole way down, switchbacks. I'm like, Jesus, Frank, what time did you leave? He's like, well, I didn't carry anything in. I tried to set a record. He made 9 miles. And, you know, hauling butt 9 miles, you're doing 2 miles an hour normally on a mountain. So, you know, you're looking at 4+ hours.
Right.
He smoked it in there in 3 hours. So he was running most of it. And, you know, we built another fire. It was still snowing, freezing. You know, warmed up. I packed up my crap, and off we went. So while that sounds probably horrible, those memories, I mean, they don't leave. Those.
Yeah, that's right up there with the books that you read.
Yeah, and, you know, we've had some definitely book-worthy stories happen. I mean, it's just – and it's not like it's the one-and-done stories where, you know, first day, first stock. It's usually day 14, dropped 16 pounds of weight, you know, out of food, you know, whatever. And then, oh, we spot a deer and something, you know. And I ended up killing, like, an 18, that big 3x3, you know, buck. The bases on that thing were huge. It was 9 years old.
Oh, wow.
And when I went on the stock, it was so steep, my toes blew through my stocking socks. And so, you know, talk about situational awareness, right? When you're making the stock, you pay attention to the deer, what you're stepping on, you know, trying to keep your mental clarity together to actually hit the damn thing. And I'm like, man, why is my toes losing feeling? Well, I look down and I've blown through my stocking socks. And so they're just pinching the crap out of my feet. So it looked like a hot dog sticking out of a bun. And, you know, whatever, right? But it was funny because that kind of stuff, it's just, you can't make that up. You can't repeat that. It's just unbelievable.
Right.
You
know, yeah, that's good stuff, man. You should write a book.
Mm. I'd actually have to write it though, but yeah, my wife has bugged me to, she would kind of be my ghost writer. I actually picked up a recorder because I had so many people bugging me to do like the Fredbear Field Note thing, like talk about, you know, document it and kind of backdate it too. Obviously I got to get enough memory where I could backdate some of the stories. Cause they're cool. You know, I like listening to Fredbear's Field Notes. I listen to those all the time. It's cool to hear, you know, people's struggles. That's why I try to post misses and everything. In the world of the internet, nobody ever wants to be honest.
Right.
No $100 bill. I mean, I get my ass kicked as much as anybody. I think it's good people to hear that there's failures by any. I mean, everybody, no matter how much I shoot, how much I strength train, I still miss and I still get my butt kicked. And that is, if it ever stops, I'll probably stop hunting and start taking more photos.
Yeah, you know, and failure has to happen. If it doesn't happen, you're never going to get those successes. I mean, I think that is probably one of the best things if taken out of this podcast is if Aaron Snyder could say that failure happens, you could say failure happens and you could stay with it. You know, don't just like a lot of the places we hunt, it is opening day and then Memorial Day weekend. And then people are like, oh, the bulls aren't bugling and this and that. And if they would just stick to it, you know, things are going to happen.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I put, you know, never F and quit on my quiver, mm-hmm. which people don't like. But that's not to say I don't ever quit. That's just what I hope to not do. I mean, very rarely do I, you know, I got a lot of cards stacked in my favor. I got a good job. I got unlimited time, unlimited training. I live at 10,000 feet. I get to shoot a lot. I got the clums by me. So I've got a lot of things helping me. But in 2000, that hunt with that Justin Wolski, with the guy I met on the mountain,
right?
He watched me miss a 203-inch mule deer that was, I mean, it killed it in rifle season 60 miles away, 32 and a half inches wide on day 11.
And,
you know, like I said, my wife is a huge part of my life. I climbed to the top of that mountain. I called her. I was like, hey, I use the F word. I'm effing done.
Right.
And, you know, that she doesn't hear that from me. And she's like, you know, what happened? I'm like, I just missed the deer of my life that I've been hunting for. That was the target deer. I mean, that was the one we'd hunted for that many days. And, you know, I about killed myself killing it. And I'm sure you heard that, like literally when he was talking about how bad that cliff face was, it was that bad. Like literally when I got out there and was his monkey, I put my string around my neck so I could face the cliff and go down. And when I got above it, my calf started to shake, and unbelievable experience, but I missed it. I climbed to the top and she said, well, hey, you got another day left before you go to Alaska. And again, I'm not whining. Oh, poor pitiful me. I got to go to Alaska. I'm just saying I really smoked and I'm like, hey, I want to see you and I'm done. And that was one of the very few times where, you know, I got the greatest short-term memory in the world. Like I can't remember what just happened. You know, misses don't bother me.
Right.
That one, that wasn't one where I'm like, oh, I'll just keep hunting. Like literally I had shame and the Eeyore moment on the top of the hill. I'm like, Jesus, dude, all that practice and all that hard work and you just screwed it up. So it was a rough one for me.
Yeah. You know, it's something about good wives. I was talking to Trent Fisher was born and raised. And you know, when he did that 50 days, elk hunt, that was one of the things that kept him going too, was he called his wife and she's like, you ain't giving up now.
Talking about, wives, right? I pulled on my mountain goat hunt the night before, I pulled an arrow out of the target. I don't know if you remember this, and I didn't know what happened at the time, but I pulled a rib out. It went in my rhomboid, and it just dropped me like a sniper hit me. And I told my wife, I was like, I can't draw my bow. And I would try, and it would just, I mean, pain like it's hard to describe. And so the next morning, I'm downstairs, and I was like, I think I'm going to have to shoot this thing with a gun. And she looked at me and said, you'll find a way. Like, you'll figure it out. And we did. We ended up, you know, shooting one. It's on video. It's crazy stock. But, you know, she wouldn't have said that. Who knows? I might have grabbed a gun and shot it. So it's good to have a good wife.
It is. It is. I think that's probably the best hunting tool a person could have.
Yeah, for the worst if your wife sucks. And
right.
I've got a few of those. So, yeah. Good one is important.
Yeah. No, good. Yeah. Having a good one is very important. So I've covered most all of the, well, you know, you could sit and talk about this all day and not cover it all. But a lot of the questions that I had, and one of the big, I guess there's a couple of other big things that I really would kind of pick your brain over. And that's so is there certain terrain that you pick to go hunt, or are there certain basins or, you know, like with an elk, you're always looking for water and then you're looking for a north facing slope nearby. And, you know, but with the mule deer up in the high country, what do you look for?
So they need feed. So like if there's willows in there, they need escape terrain. So if there's not, if it's the most beautiful basin in the world and the back of it is sheer cliffs, they probably won't live there. They need to escape. So saddles, things like that, look for goat paths where they're going to be coming out of. You know, cliff edges, places to get out of the sun, basically. And you can figure out where they're going to bed in the morning and the evening. You always want to glass a place in the morning and the evening, because if they're not there in the morning as the sun rotates, they're probably going to be there in the evening. And then you're also going to know where they're at in the morning, so you're going to be able to figure out what basin they potentially came from. So spots with shade, you know, whether that's bristlecone or cliff edges, things like that, food, water. They don't need that much water, but, you know, there generally is water going to be somewhat nearby. And then pressure, you know, you're going to look for where hikers, campers, hunters aren't. And the issue we have, and you might run into, but probably not Nevada, is elk season. We'll have people camp right in the middle of the base the deer live in, you know, and, you know, so they're looking at camping there where the elk may come up, but they're dropping down in the timber. So if there's escape terrain, you're good. If there's water somewhere and they don't have to have it, it's not a bad idea. Food and then shade. They got to have shade and then, you know, the least amount of pressure.
Gotcha. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense when you start talking about the shade thing. I didn't even think that, or the steep cliffs, you know, where they could get out. I didn't even think about that either.
Most of the deer that we go after are generally not, you know, they're in, I'm looking for deer, specific deer in cliffs. Like when I say cliffs, and South's videos are great, watch those. You want to find that deer 10 yards below a cliff face, staying out of the sun. You know, when you're going to come out on top of it, he is going to have no idea you're there. Now, that's one thing you do need to do, is you need to practice shooting off cliffs, because it sucks. You know, you'll hit your calf with your limb, your string is in your armpit. You're going to be all kinds of contorted in, you know, I practiced a bunch and I still missed, right? You got to practice goofy.
Right. What, before I let you go, what's the biggest difference between hunting them with the trad bow and your compound?
Oh, that's easy. When I know they're bedded, I'll give it a scenario and this will explain it all. Frank flagged me in, $6 bedded, which is not uncommon. They're, you know, bachelored up. $6 bedded in bristlecone and white pine or sparsy pine. I got about 22 yards behind them. One of the 3x3s came out, faced me at 11 yards. It wasn't a buck I wanted to shoot. And, you know, not that I'm the greatest trophy in the world. I just want to shoot it, right? I mean, it'll grow. So buck came out to the left. It was a 3x4. Not a buck I wanted to shoot. Now, keep in mind, I'm somewhere between 17 and 23 yards of these deer. They started to get a little twitchy, you know, and so when the big buck came out, he didn't get 190 for no reason. He did not come out where they did because he could see there was something off and skirted around, you know, totally to where he could wind me, and they blew out. With a compound at 23, I would have hung back at 50. They would have never seen me. When that buck came out, I would have shot him at 55 yards.
Gotcha.
Can't do that with it. Got to get closer. So just getting close is the big one. And finding, again, when you're looking at, let's say, 40 to 60 for most compound guys is their honey hole. You know, for me, I can shoot fairly well. 40 is still a poke and not a shot I really want to take. And so when you're able to get 40 to 60 back, you've not only opened up, obviously, that issue that I just talked about where deer may see you when they get out of their bed, what you've also opened up is the amount of deer you can even stalk, because there is multiple deer that bed that I just can't get close enough to, you know, because of where they're bedded and there's nothing between us and them, bigger deer where they're safe. So with a compound, especially, some guys can drop bombs at 80, 90 yards. you know, but 40 to 60 is realistic. You know, you and I are 20 to 30. And as I say that, shit, I hope they're 4 to 10, right? I want to be as close as I can. There's not going to be that many deer that bed like that. So that limits it. And then, too, you know, how far you're hanging back when they stand out of their bed. If you're at 45 and a deer gets up and catches the glare of your watch, you've probably still got 5 seconds for him to kind of assess what's going on. When you're at 11 yards, he ain't assessing shit. He's blowing out. And when I say blow out, he's leaving the country. You may not see him for 3 to 4 days.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, when we talk about this a lot, and I crack a lot of jokes, you know, $10,000 in Sitka gear on, don't face. Your face is the most they don't do elbow recognition, the CIA. They're doing facial recognition. Same thing. So if you're going in there, paint your hands, turn your wristwatch backwards, put it towards your palm, so they're not going to see the sheen of that watch. You know, that seems overboard, but ask Sal. They will blow out from the shine of a watch.
Yeah.
And think about it. If I'm hunting you, right, and I'm hiding behind a tree eating, and I look back and I see your sunglasses flare, well, that's not in the woods. And I see guys want to be cool throwing Oakleys, you know, on their head, shining like crazy. Well, that's bad, right? You do not want any sheen. So I paint my limbs. Danny Klum told multiple stories about this, that sheen of that limb. I know, I'm sure if it's a new bow, you don't want to paint it. Make it dull where it's not shiny. Camo is not that important. The dull color, like, you know, Fred Bear wasn't lying. I mean, flannel's fine, right? I mean, anything that breaks up your outline.
Right.
But shiny is bad. And so that's what you're really, your face, you want to put dark on the highs and light on the lows. So make sure and get darkness on your cheekbones, your nose, your chin. At least break up the outline so they know they're not looking at a human.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, cool, man. I sure appreciate your time coming on here. And now I'm really getting stoked about this. I really need to get after it and probably lose some weight and then get some of my meals figured out too, get some dehydrated meals figured out. But I sure appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, no problem, man. Anytime. And, like, you know, as time goes on, you're getting closer. If you got other questions, you know, by all means, you know, fire away. I'll help you as much as I can.
Right on. Well, I think we'll leave it there, and then I'll probably come up with some more questions, and I'll hit you up later if you're not too busy down the road.
No, sounds good, man. I appreciate you having me on.
All right, and for those of you that didn't listen to that podcast, do you remember what number that podcast was that we were referring to?
It's called Lessons Learned, but I'll pull it up real quick. Just give me one.
I probably should have already had that.
That podcast was funny because you also learn a lot about me as a human.
Yeah.
I'll do anything to help anyone, but I'll probably also call you a fat ass.
So that's fine.
Because I would have done anything to get that dude a deer. He's just an awesome guy. So give me one sec. I'm pulling it up here. So it was Lessons Learned and... Man, it doesn't have the number here. Well, it's Lesson Learned, so if you Google it, just type in that and you'll find it. Lesson Learned Kafaru Cast.
Yeah, and you guys, it's worth a listen, man. I mean, even if you're not ever planning on going mule deer hunting, just to see what guys do and how guys help each other. And it was a great podcast. I really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, it was good meeting that dude. That dude was a stud for being probably 60 pounds overweight. The fact that it was something to be said. So
yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, thanks again for having me on. And yeah, anytime I can help you out, just let me know.
All right, thanks a bunch. We'll talk to you later. Thanks, Aaron.
Yep, take it easy.
Thanks for joining us for another installment of the Bear Bow Hunter Podcast. Remember, we couldn't even be talking about this stuff if it wasn't for our public land. So go and support the people that are protecting it, backcountry hunters and anglers and TRCP. Also, if you'd like to see more of Bear Bow Hunters, go to our Facebook group, go to our Instagram at Bear Bow Hunters, like us, and hashtag all of your photos with your Bear Bow goodness in them, Bear Bow Hunter. We have a website as well. You can go over there. Check out the rest of the podcast. We have videos, we have t-shirts and hats. Thanks again. And
Until then, shoot straight.